and they're all in entanglement distribution.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Can you adjust the lights? There's something.
Yeah. Is that okay? Or
should
yeah, I?
That's good.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. My talk is based on this paper here, so hopefully at the end I'll expect you to read this. So, overview of the talk. So, what I'm going to talk about mostly are these states called qubit singlets. Other people have called them dark states or super singlets, but this is the term that we're going to use. So I'm going to set the scene, use background information of them, and summarise some previous results. Then I'll get on to our main results, which first of which is that the states of the ground states have been particular Hamiltonian for any graph. The second result is that you can take arbitrary measurements on any particular components of that state, and the remainder will be in a smaller singlet. Then I'll show that these states have the highest possible persistency of entanglement. And then I'll just go through some uses of these states and questions for the future. Okay, and potentially preparing them in an optimal practice. Okay, so just to introduce them, these states originally were considered by Adam Carolli. Originally, Sir Akbar set conference of states which could solve problems with a classical solution, and he came up with these states which did solve three problems, one of which is a secret chain problem, which I'll just quickly go through. Now, suppose Alice 1 wants to have a secret action taken on her behalf at this, this location. And she has agents A2 to AN to do it for her. Now, Alice 1 knows that some are dishonest, but does not know which. She can't send a secure message to all, because the dishonest parties will sabotage it. So we can assume that if they all carry it out together, the honest ones will prevent the dishonest ones damaging the task. So what's boiled down to is that A1 needs to send the key to A2 to AN so that they can only read it if they were perfect. Now, you can show that this problem is exactly equivalent to this problem. So, if you solve if all the n parties have a sequence of numbers that is truly random and it contains integers running from 0 to n minus 1, if number I is at position j in k sequence, does not appear at position j in l sequence. Okay. And they only know their own sequences. Now this is impossible to achieve classically, such as eavesdroppers and so on, random numbers, etc. So, we need a method to generate such sequences. A1 sequence is defined as the key.
Sorry, in operational terms, what are they trying to do there? Like, are they trying to send messages to one, to several people? Or?
She's trying to send a key to all of them. And then, well, I'll show you in detail in the next slide, actually, what's going to happen.
Okay, and there are eavesdroppers on the line?
Yeah.
All the lines?
Yeah.
Potentially some of the recipients of the messages are collaborating with the eavesdroppers?
Mm-hmm. Now, A1 sequence is defined as the key. And the only way to reveal it is to make the remaining part share their respective keys, sorry, sequences. And then we can code the key by filling in the gaps. So what I mean by that, I don't know if you can see this is grey and these are black. So this is defined as the key. These guys each have their own sequence. As you can see, this number here does not appear at that position in any other person's sequence. So then you can guess. When these guys have got their sequences and they share them with each other, they can then fill in the gaps to see what A1 sequence is. So this is the way in which they cooperate, so they can fill in the gaps. Okay?
Yeah, but A4, sorry, A4 gets partial information about the secret, right? When he receives the key.
There's no secret, this is as setting up the keys.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is the key. I mean, this is what we want to distribute. We want A, 2, 3, A, and 4 to have knowledge of this key, so then together they can do this particular task. And the only way they can do this is if they all share their keys. Now, of course, there's a problem where if one person lies about their key, you can repeat that. You can repeat it several times and you can find out who the liar is, because there's a probability that their result has already been...
Okay, but if two of those people get together, then they have a 50% chance of guessing what the key is. Much better than that. Without any information.
well, at least each number.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it is very fresh.
I have no question.
The point is that each of the individual people has a lot of partial information about
the key. Yeah.
So it's not. Well, yeah. So I don't know. It's.
Yeah, but I mean, to get the complete one, they need to all cooperate, and they have a large number of these. I mean, this is just the same thing before. So yeah, there's a high probability that you could get if you have 25 people or something like that.
But there are exist other constructions where individual participants are in a subset. Has absolutely no information about the key. And here they have partial information about the key. So it's not as well. It may be useful in other respects, but it's not optimal.
Yeah. I mean, this is not the main thing in my work. It's just a kind of toy problem which is going used to motivate these things. But yeah, I know it's not a particular principle. So here we go, this is if someone lies. So if the dishonest party D, the players are dishonest, an incorrect result, then there's a particular probability that someone else has already obtained that result. Okay. And then they stop, and then the key is still not declared. And they still have some partial information, but the key's not declared. And then when they do it again, but they commute they commute the order. So D is not always last. So, yeah. If they repeat it many times, then on the average, it should work. Two other problems reduce to exactly the same problem: head strange problem and lie detection problem. And they're discussed in more detail here. So these states are you know, that should be there. But these states are useful because they can solve these problems, and I'll show you why later on. So first of all, just introduce the states before I tell you how these states can be used to solve that problem. So there are n parts of D-level states with this particular property, where if you do a particular local unitary on every spin, then you end up with the same states up to a global phase. Each party is a spin D minus 1 over 2, and total spin is 0. For the special case of the number of levels of upper sites being the same, then we have this nice formal for it. So it really is a generalization of the standard Bell singlet. And we call this an n-singlet. Sum is taken over all possible combinations, and it's anti-symmetric under all permutation operators because we have this anti-symmetric tensor here. And they are essentially pure multi-partite invariant states. So, one of the major properties of these singlets is that if all the parties choose a particular basis, must be the same one for each, then when each one measures a particular spin, the smaller singlet is established at each stage between the other parties. So here, if the first line measures and you obtain result of 5, then the others share a singlet of levels 1 to 4. So the next line measures you get 2, and so on. And then at the end, this is the standard belt singlet of levels 1 and 4. So this is how the sequences are distributed to all the parties, because it has the property that if you get number 2, then you won't here, then you won't get number 2 anywhere. So if they share a large number of copies of this n singlet, then asymptotically they can solve the problem. So here's just a few. I mean, there are many more tags here, but just a few here. You see, so this is the key, and these are their own sequences. So if they have a large number of these, then an A1 measures each one, then you know, quarter of them will have 2 here, quarter of them have 1 here, and so on. And so they have their keys. So, just to summarise some previous results, if the same arbitrary rotation is applied to each qubit, the same is the same, and they all measure any basis, then the smallest thing is established at each stage. So, some other previous results for general number of levels of sites now. As I say, they're essentially pure multipartite Fermi states for this special case D. They don't exist when the number of sites is less than the number of levels, but they do exist otherwise. They may be used as the basis of the coherence free subspace. And it's conjectured that when n is a multiple of d, then there are n orthogonal such states. And this hasn't been proved, so something I'm trying to prove now. And maybe you may be using multi-party remote state preparation. So they've got a variety of uses, but no one really knows how to make them.
Sorry, I mean, for the n equals, the question of the number of them, isn't that just. You apply some standard representation theory to find out the number of them?
Yeah, I think so. It hasn't been done yet. I mean, this is where I'm trying to prove my point. So we'd like to evaluate these states, but there are not much progress has been made so far. And only then the case of Hamiltonian process. So what we're doing here is consider an intermassive Hamiltonian, which may also be implemented in the optimal axis. Condensed matter Hamiltonian.
Condensed matter, sorry.
Which is also available to optimal axis, but only for the special case D equals N here. Okay. So our three main results. The first is the least seen mix in the ground state of the two left of Hamiltonian. Second is that one can use any measure basis to establish small cubic singlets as successive measures. Previously, everyone has to use the same basis, but here we've shown that you can use any basis. Follows from that these states have the most consistency possible. And then I'll discuss potential realization of the state. So, first result with any ground state. Suppose we have a graph here, and each vertex there is a D-level system. And this each connection represents a term of Hamiltonian. Pij, which meets the states connected by. Now that's an element of FUD, so D-levels. So then the Hamiltonian for the system is this. So each term here is a permutation operator. And this is a generalization of the Heisenberg inspection. And we can show that the ground state of this is a singlet, independent of the choice of the graph G. So as we know, the permutation operator is just typically defined like that. And you can write this in terms of the generators of FUD in this form. So the first lemma is that the lowest energy state of a permutation Hamiltonian has an energy equal to that of an eigenstate of all Pij terms included in the Hamiltonian, each larger than minus 1. So in this case, we're claiming that the lowest energy state could be an eigenstate of all the lines that are there. So of course, to minimize the energy, this inequality. The minimal of each term on the right hand side is minus 1. So therefore, the minimal energy is bounded by minus nc. Nc is the number of links in the graph. So, an equality exists for a state that is individually an eigenstate of all possible terms in the Hamiltonian. If this state exists, then it must be a ground state. We know this state does exist. Now, if a state is an eigenstate of all permutation operators in Hamiltonian here, then it's an eigenstate of all possible permutation operators. So here, what I'm claiming now is that if it's an eigenstate of all these guys here, then it must also be an eigenstate of others, such as P1, 4. Now, this is quite simple to show because you can build up an arbitrary permutation in terms of nearest neighbor transpositions. So here, P1, 4, is just equal to products of these guys. So you just swap each one, each pair, and then you go back the other way. Yeah.
So your ground state in the end is independent of the graph as long as the graph is connected?
Yes, that's the graph, yeah. So an eigenstate of all nearest neighbor permutations must be an eigenstate of all permutations. It's always an odd number as well, so it serves the minus one point value. And you can easily generalize that to any graph. It doesn't just have to be a line like this. So using these two lemmas, we can put this theorem into a theorem, which is the ground state of an SUN permutation Hamiltonian on a lattice of SIX is this N singlet. So we know that a state completely unstretched had all permutations is a valid ground state, and by definition this state satisfies this. And we can prove that it's a unique ground state by contradiction, which is what I do here. Now, that's the first result, which shows it's a ground state of a generalization of the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So now the second result is that you can take any measurement you like and establish smaller qubit singlets. So, previously it was known that if you measure one of them in one basis, then the others share a singlet in that basis. But what if we want to measure a new basis, which is represented by a tilting of this aggregate? So, well, if you just think this through logically, if you just perform the same unitary and all, we still would have seen it here, but it's in a different basis. Then we measure this one, and we get a particular result. Then we know that these guys are still in the same bit in that new basis. And then we perform the inverse operation on all these others that we haven't measured back to the original basis. And what we get is a state that we've measured in this new basis and a singlet in the old basis. So we find that this is indeed true. So you can take a measurement in any basis and you still get a singlet at the end. So to prove this, we first need this property, which is if you do a unitary operation on one spin, one qubit, that's the same as doing nothing on that qubit and the adjoint operation on all the others. Now, for a two-level singlet, this is easy to show as well then. You just simply go through this mass here, so that decomposes the density here with u, decompose that, and then by definition, this u cross u just disappears. Now we can easily generalize that. So what we claim now is that if we have an n singlet in this particular basis alpha, and we measure it at one qubit, using an arbitrary measurement basis here. We get a product of beta I at the measured sites and an n minus 1 singlet, a smaller singlet, in this new basis at the other qubits. Now I'll just introduce this notation here as well. This Sn minus 1, this means that it's just, say it's an n minus 1 singlet instead of n. It's in the beta basis here, but beta L, level beta L has been excluded, so we have all levels beta 1 to beta L minus 1 and beta L plus 1 to beta n minus 1, no, sorry, to beta n. So then we perform this measurement here. Now since this is directly related to measurement in this basis, we can write this, which is that we do this measurement at one spin, I didn't see anywhere else, and we just use the previous properties, so we just plug this in here, and then we just swap these around by this previous property, and we have this same diagram again. Okay. Now you can write the singlet in this form. So this is because it looks like a bit like a stated term when you write it. This is just like decomposing a determinant to smaller ones. And then when you apply identity at one place and unitary everywhere else, which is what we have here, what you get is this. So it's not this effective. And here we have a unitary acting on the singlet here. And this is a singlet in the new basis. Using a basic transformation. So then the outcome is this. You have this singlet in basis alpha. You do a measurement in beta basis at one particular place. And what you end up with is a new singlet in this new basis. Now this might seem simple because by definition if you do the same unitary everywhere you get the same state. But if we iterate this, we can see the importance of it. So they're passed to form successive measurements in arbitrary basis here, Bn. So each one is linked to the previous one by the unitary UL. Then the remaining guys can be measured share n minus m singlets in this basis. So it's the basis that leads to the final measurement to be n minus m. Okay? But the restriction is that each basis transformation, each successive measurement, operates in a space one dimension smaller than the previous. And we'll lift this restriction a little bit later on. Now, to prove this, consider the effect of measuring in this basis alpha 2 on the output of the previous measurement. So the final result is this. And then, in general, after our measurements, you get this. So then here's your n minus m singlet with these guys excluded, because this is the index of the one you've got here. And this is the new basis. This basis is the basis that was used for the final measurements. Okay. Now the restriction where you have to get use a smaller unitary each particular time arises because of this property. Now this only holds when u operates in the space encountered by the singlet. Okay, so at the alpha measurement you can only use the basis transformation that operates on either within the space which is occupied by the singlet or the orthogonal space, not the space. It's not allowed to link to spaces. Okay. But we can break this d-level unitary down in terms of two-level unitary scale. So we get this decomposition here. So now we can use any d by d unitaries such that each of these factors acts within the space occupied by the singlet or complementary space, in which case it just acts as the identity of the singlet space. But what happens now if we really use any basics? So we're using a unitary transformation such that it links the space occupied by the singlet and the remaining space. Well, here we have an arbitrary node of the unitaries here acting on this two singlet here, Jm minus Mj. Now suppose this acts on J, not M. So then we get this. But this still looks like a singlet, but it's just in a different basis. We just moved it into a different part of the Hilbert space. But it's still a singlet. So we conclude that you can use any basis. When n parts are sharing a qubit singlet and m of them perform local measurements, the remaining of them share a smaller singlet regardless of the measurement choice or indeed the outcome of the measurement. So if you have this state, you measure successive spins, you get whatever you like, any measurement basis, you always get a smaller singlet at the end.
So do you have to know the outcome of these measurements? Otherwise you get a mixed state, right?
Yeah, you have to know what, yeah, that's right, yeah. But you can measure, but yeah, you can choose your basis. So we can use this to make some new claims about these states. Now the first is that they have a higher persistence of entanglement. So this is defined as the minimum number of local phenomenal measurements that you need to perform on a state in order to completely destroy the entanglement. And this could be considered as a measure of function partial entanglement. For cluster states, it's approximately n by 2, where n is the number of properties in the state. But here, we show that it's n minus 1. So if you have an n partite state, you really need to measure every single one of them except the last one to destroy the entanglements. And this has to be the highest possible value for an n partite state. Now, for most contributing tasks, of course, such as communication and so on, we need entanglements to be shared by well-separated parties. Difficult to achieve by just distributing photons. So one thing we could do is create a spin chain and use localized entanglements. So we try to concentrate entanglements within the ends. Now this quantity is defined as the maximum amount of entanglement you can concentrate between the two parts. Normally you have to optimize over the measurement basis very carefully. This can be quite tricky. But here, as I've shown you, it's all basis independent. So you can establish entanglement over a long distance. By doing any measurement you like. So we introduce a thing called two subsystems of classical entanglement. Normally, you just concentrate on between two qubits. But here, suppose Alice and Bob have access to two particular parts of the graph, each being qubits. Then they can establish this number of e-bits between them. Because suppose now we have this system, and it's graph independent, so they choose what they like. Bob has access to these three, and Alice has access to these three. And then they measure the middle and concentrate six singlet between them. So the number of e-bits is this. Okay. Now this is relevant physically because we now need to distribute entanglement over quite a long distance. And now to go on to the final thing, which is the physical realization of these states. Now, as I said, you can write experimentation operation in terms of these elements of SUV. Now, this can be written like this. And it turns out that this holds for both fermionic and bosonic creation and annihilation operators. So potentially, you can have many implementations here. Some that we consider are optical traps, quantum dots, and spin tubes. Actually, it's quite a natural interaction if you consider it. If you have a lattice and there are things hopping in the lattice, and you can't have multiple occupancy of a lattice. So, in that sense, a natural thing to consider would be the Hubble model. And indeed, you can obtain this Hamiltonian from the Hubble model in particular limits. Now, it's known that you can obtain the Heisenberg Hamiltonian from the Hubble model, and so you can simulate a spin chain in the Hubble model. And I'll just go through that, and then we'll just generalize that equation to our case. So standard Hubble Hamiltonian is this, and in fact, this what I'll show you holds for both fermions and bosons because we choose U such that you never get double occupancy. So consider this in the half-filled regime. So there are no unoccupied sites and no sites with multiple occupancy. We tune U much, much better than the hopping pixel. And then we eliminate the number of fluctuations. And the energy cost of leaving the half-field subspace is very, very large. So we always have this one spin per site. So now we treat the hopping term as a perturbation. And we obtain an effective conversion in here, which is equal to this. So you expand this, and it turns out, and you only keep the terms which confine the state to singular occupancy subspace, because U is large, and these states are pretty correct. And then what we get is we get this. And this is actually exactly the same as this. If you write this out and you add an identity term, which has an effect on energy, then you get this. So you really can get the Heisenberg Hamiltonian from an optical lattice with this is the exchange interval. So now we just add more levels. So now we have D levels in every single site. And we just repeat the derivation in this 1 by D thin imaging. By which I mean if you have D sites and D levels, then each one's up by once. Each state is one to many ones. Okay, so now we have this effective Hamiltonian. And this is exactly the same as this if you write this out in terms of these creation and annihilation effects, which is the shape. So you can get this Hamiltonian from a Hopping model Hamiltonian. You can also get it from a generalized Schrödinger Wolf transformation, which has been done here in the case of the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So, physically, how would we do this? Well, there are some candidate systems. We need some degenerate levels, for example, hyperlevels. And recently it's been reported that you can get 10 levels with potassium and 22 with erbium. So, some other candidate systems.
I have a tricky question here. So, I mean, you have told me that connection between the Hubble model and how you implement the optic lattice support. But now I'm curious. I mean, the normal Hubble model sort of, well, has sort of one plate or however you call it. You have a top in your lattice, and that can hop around.
Yeah.
And therefore, that parameter which describes that process is called T for tunneling.
Yeah.
But now you seem to be using sort of a stationary lattice with the qubits, sort of a physical system sitting at their lattice size, and they have sort of enough hyperfine splitting, so a number of states that they can. Or maybe you go back to that with the Hamiltonian that you showed. Now you can sort of, you can now change the internal states of these atoms.
Yes.
So you sort of, you also have a coupling of sort of lowering, say, the occupation number of one such level and sort of increasing the occupation of on a neighboring site.
Yes, yeah.
And but how would that process be physically mediated? It appears to me now that the atoms are sitting in their place. There's no tunneling going on. So what would be the physical process which results in that effective Hamiltonian?
I guess if you have you have an atom here which is occupying one of the levels, atom in the next atom is occupying another level, then they do kind of, you can still have the atom hopping, they both hop at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the repulsion is very, we make that frame very large, so when one starts to hop, the other one jumps out.
Oh, okay, so the
yeah. Okay, other systems. It has been shown that you can simulate HUN Hamiltonians in spin ladders and spin tubes. Another potential way is to have lots of quantum dots. This has been done, or has been shown to be possible, I think, for four levels, for an HU4 Hamiltonian. You have lots of quantum dots. You have two orbital levels and two spin levels. You have four possible levels. So if you just have other quantum dots with more orbital levels, you could potentially do this as well. Now, just to go through some uses of these states. This is some open problems and things that I'm doing at the moment. The first interpretation and potentially using these for a metric based quantum computing, making very nice one solid from these. Another potential use might be, well, see if we can derive some kind of value inequalities for these states. And then there are some other open problems. So teleportation, exactly the same as a standard cluster state or GZ teleportation here. So now Alice and Charlie share this three parts of that state. We want to teleport from here to here. So we just perform measurements each successive site. Now the question is this possible because at each successive measurement the state the space in which the state lives in shrinks every time. But can we still use it for this? So this is what I'm trying to do right now. And if you can do that, can you then generalize it to a measurement-based quantum computing? Possibly not, because a lot of things are basis independent, which is not really what we want to do for quantum computation, but it's still an interesting question. Another thing is to make a covalent quantum solid out of these guys. So it's well known that you can just put lots of things together and make a spin chain. Just kind of matrix product states. But can we do it with these guys? So this, we get some three things here, and then we project as the symmetric subspace of each place here, and we end up with a nice triangle lattice, which I'm sure will be completely unphysical, but might be quite an interesting system to consider. Some other questions that I'm considering at the moment. Are there multi-qubit states with as much persistence as these? Because at the moment, I think the highest is n by 2 for cluster states. It would be interesting to see if there is a state which is twice as entangled as that. What do they look like for general D and A? And for which number of levels and sites do they actually exist? Now, for bipartite case, it was shown way back by Werner that these guys only exist, they're only pure when, for the bipartite case, when n equals 2, you can't have bipartite singlets with more levels than that. But, so, what I'm trying to do now is using, and that came from this condition here. So you write rho in terms of an LSE and a flip operator, and then you use this condition and then you can prove exactly that. What I'm trying to do now is generalize that. So I'm trying to prove for which DNA exists. It might exist for quantum logic. And then I would like to prove the conjecture that for n is multiple of d qubits, there are m orthogonal such states. Then that can be used as a basis of deep-packet free states. So, just to summarise, I've introduced these states, summarised the previous results. I've shown that the ground state of a two-level Hamiltonian regardless of the graph. I've shown you can take ultra measurements and still get a singlet. And I've shown that they have the highest possible distance to entanglement, and just discussed some potential uses and implementations. So, just to say thank you very much for your time. And okay, questions.
So what's the definition of persistence in entanglement here?
So the number of, if you have an n-partite state, it's the number of measurements you need, local measurements you need to take to completely destroy the entanglement.
So I think then that just a random state would have basically maximal persistence in entanglement, right?
So it's the minimum number of measurements you need to take to complete this entanglement. So a completely mixed.
Completely random.
Yeah.
Random. So random should have very high persistence, correct? Because
I think so. I guess I don't know.
But since it's kind of the unentangled state, it's a very special state, right? And if you take any marginal of a completely random state, it's also going to be random. But again, it's disentangled conditioned on the outcome. Is that right?
In general, I...
It's not tracing over qubits. It's taking the measure.
No, it's taking the measure. Yeah.
So,
but I think it should go on to the measurement outcome.
So it has to be entangled regardless of the measure. Even so, I would think there would be a mistake.
Okay, well, I think that's quite just what we should stop at. Harry, I'm not sure how you would necessarily cross my map, yes.
So, do you know something? So you said the grass is independent of the interaction graph. Do you know something about the gap? Say, is the gap, I mean, maybe you have sort of studied this, or at least numerically, the grass energy gap, is it larger if the grass is very connected? Can you say something about that?
I think the more connections there are, the lower the energy, because
the smaller the gap?
Well, the lower the graphite energy first.
Okay, fine.
First of all, because the number of terms in one term is greater, so you can get more terms than minus one. The energy gap, well, I haven't really considered excited states of the chain. But that seems plausible, yeah, for the same reason, that there are more terms.
Yeah, that's what you would think. They are all, in a way, enforcing the same constraints. So you have more, but maybe there are surprises. So,
Thanks. No, you haven't looked at the other states of the on the same object.
Okay. So, if there are no further questions at this point, then let's thank the speaker again. And Chris is in 351.
Yeah, so sorry.